So how you guys doing? I think I mentioned, I don't know if everybody's here, not planning to have a final. I will try to catch up. I mean, my guess is I'm not going to quite get to you all of the setups to ask you to rank, but I'm going to give that a shot. Maybe even I'll stretch that until after class a day or two, since I'm not on the final. I can't feel conflicted about asking you to spend a half an hour reading a few essays and then I can't. But so this is an odd course in the sense that we have this very bizarre theme that requires really a vast amount of background to really talk about concepts. And I mean, we really have all of that now. And the story has been sort of spread out the entire semester. So what I wanted to do today, maybe it'll stretch into Monday a little bit, is to basically go through and tell the story again, adding some new pieces as we go, but more or less trying to pull it together into more of a coherent story than perhaps we've been able to do so far. So, you know, so this whole idea of multiple universe may sound pretty crazy because you sort of think of the universe as all-encompassing. Oh, that didn't work at all. So I have some darker slides this time, so at the risk of putting everybody to sleep, I'm going to go ahead and make it dark. You know, the universe you think of as defining everything, and so the whole idea of a multiple universe comes into play when you realize that there are parts of reality or an invented reality, either way you want to think about it, it could be perhaps real, that is outside of the regime that we could, in principle, ever be causally connected to. And so so I think it is okay to talk about the possibility of multiple universes. So we define the one as the totality of the objects in the cosmic macrocosm, but the totality of existence. So you can sort of imagine defining the universe in a way where you can't really have a multiple universe, because if it's the totality of existence, if you think of existence as having an existence without us ever being causally contacted and connected to it, then I suppose not. So the working definition that I use is, you know, this: everything that could exist or ever exists in our experience. And, of course, you now have learned a lot about what we think we know about our universe, in that the space is expanding, and in fact that expansion is accelerating. So there is a finite region of reality that can ever be our causal universe, because our causal universe is limited by that. It grows at the speed of light. And as the universe's expansion is accelerating, as we get further away, the space is actually moving away from us faster than the speed of light. So in fact, our little tidbit of reality is even shrinking, if you want to think about it that way. So that's I like to use the cosmological multiverse because it's a little bit easier to visualize than some of the others. But quantum mechanics postulates, you know, a many-dimensional space we call Hilbert space, of which we can only experience pieces of it. And so, again, in principle, you could have a reality that's causally disconnected from us. So this, once you have this kind of definition, you can have a multiverse. And at the start of the term, we talked about all the different kinds of multiverses that are many of them, any rate, that one can imagine. And we've actually talked about a lot of these. This mathematical multiverse is this craziness that we talked about from Max Tegmark. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. We have the cosmological multiverses here, and I call them pretty scientific because they are inferred from pretty well-supported scientific data. That does not mean we have any evidence of them directly. It's just we have evidence that supports an expanding universe, and evidence is beginning to support inflation, and if you have that, then these kinds of multiverses sort of follow directly. Just because I've defined the multiverse as some sort of reality where we can't be causally connected to, it's really hard to get rid of the fact that you can have some that are just complete manufacturers of human mind and principle. You can believe in it or not. But there's the real distinction here is there's no scientific evidence of something. So you can imagine heaven or hell or different transcendental planes of reality that people talk about in human culture, but you sort of believe in it or not. But I distinguish them because these are not sort of inferred from scientific methodology at this point. And you can certainly argue about whether any of these are scientific at some level because you can't, they're not falsifiable, short of the Fecan multiverse, which I talked about a little bit, we'll talk about a little bit more today. Similarly, sort of the scientific realm in which these things sit varies. So the many worlds multiverse is really coming out of quantum mechanics. And then we have a whole bunch of different types of multiverses that seem to be coming out of cosmology. And, this mathematical multiverse that we talked about, that Tegmark has hypothesized, it does sort of have something of an origin about our knowledge about mathematics and things, but it's really hard to call it a scientific. It's probably more of a faith thing too. So I'm using slides, which I often will give as a just complete introduction to the things, to some of this we've just seen already. I've talked about this guy, Vesta Slipher. Here's actually a picture of him. And he's the guy who looked at the nearby set of galaxies and realized that they were moving away from us, making use of the Doppler shift, which we've talked about. That is when an object is moving away or toward us, the frequency of the light is shifted in the same way that the pitch of sound is shifted. If you have something coming toward you, the pitch will be higher than it is it's receiving from you. So when cars go by, so that kind of thing. You have sort of this exact same thing with light. You have to pull in relativity, so the equations are a little bit different, but basically you come up with the same type of thing. The degree to which the frequency of the light gets shifted depends on the speed of recession or the speed with which it's coming toward you. It doesn't have to be the object moving. You can be moving toward the object or away, so it's just relative motion that's important. But because the frequency shift is important, if you can use certain markers in frequency, for example, spectral lines for different atoms, we know if they're at rest with respect to us, what the spectral lines, what frequencies they shine for different atomic nuclei. And you can look at either absorption or emission lines from different atomic nuclei from various objects. No matter how far away, if you can actually see the light, you can, in principle, analyze it by spreading it out via frequency and look to see where you have bright lines or where you have dark lines. So what I mean by that is if the object is far away and there's a gas that's cool in front of it, then what will happen is you'll have light emitted and it will get absorbed with those spectral lines. If, in fact, the gas is part of the object and it's hot, then it will be emitting at those spectral lines. And it doesn't matter whether you're looking at the bright spectral lines or the absorbed spectral lines. You can do it either way. So Slipher noticed that these fuzzy objects, he didn't really know they were galaxies at the time, were all moving away from us, and it was a very puzzling thing. And then Edwin Hubble and a fellow named Humason who worked at Mount Palomar Observatory, they took distance measurements that Hubble had determined by using the period of oscillation in the brightness of a type of star called Cepheid variable stars that, working at Mount Palomar, which is a huge telescope, he was able to resolve in nearby galaxies. So when he correlated the distance measurements with the redshift measurements that Slipher had when these two guys did that, this is the plot they got. And this is sort of original data, so you look at this and you go, well, it's sort of correlated, but it doesn't knock you over the head. But this really is the origin of this idea that we have the expanding universe. And as time has passed, we have better data on this, and so this would be more recent data. The problem is, as you look at things that are farther and farther away, even if you have no gas or anything else in between you and that object is very, very far away. And the further away it gets, the dimmer it appears to us, and it can become too dim for us to image. So the energy that's emitted by an object flows like a sphere, and the area of the sphere grows as 1 over the radius squared. Because if you look at the area of the sphere, that's 4 pi r squared. So that means you take the same amount of energy that's produced and you're spreading it over more and more space as you get further and further away. And that means the energy that's incident on anything that's out here observing it falls off as 1 over the distance squared. And so that's really what makes things dim down as 1 over the distance squared as you try to observe them. So this becomes really quite hard to do. So to look at distances, and you might want to look at the scales here. This is a modern, well, I'll show you even a more modern plot, but this plot's from 1996. Note that this scale is 2 megaparsecs. This scale is approaching 500 megaparsecs. So over large distances, you can see now this very strong correlation between the velocity of recession of objects and the distance to them. And so in the picture, so that picture is consistent with the space itself expanding, just like if you had raisins and raisin bread dough fairly close together and fairly far apart, okay? As the dough expands, the ones that are fairly close together move apart a little bit, so the velocity of recession is what it is. But the ones that are further apart will move apart more in the same amount of time. You get more dough expanding, and that velocity of recession is much higher. And so that's really what this picture is telling us. In order to make this happen, you have to use a so-called standard candle that's very, very bright. And so the standard candle we use is a supernova, because that's the brightest, pretty much the brightest thing you can imagine. There are active galactic nuclei, I guess, that do things where they emit more energy and would be brighter than supernova themselves. But for supernova happen in any galaxy that's out there, you'll occasionally get a supernova. And supernova are extremely bright, so you can look at supernova from vast distance and try to determine how far away the object is. The problem is that how do you know how bright the supernova is? That's a big issue. And so what happens with the supernova is, here's a picture of a galaxy, and you're going to see a star actually blow up here. It's a real star. And what's going to be plotted is going to be the intensity of the light as a function of time. So you'll see the star turn on, and as it does, it will get bright here, and then it will slowly dim down. This is a picture of a galaxy. This is a real event. And as it gets bright, what you have here is a spectral analysis of the light that's emitted.
What's the time scale, though?
The time scale is on the order of 10 to 20 days. And that's actually one of the really important things here, because most things that happen on cosmic scales happen over such long periods of time that we can't infer anything over a normal human's lifetime. But here, these events happen. You have tremendous production of energy over a period of days. And just to give you a sense of it, in a standard, and this is a very rough number, I'm no expert, but in a standard type 1A supernova, the amount of energy produced in that few days is equivalent to that which is produced by our sun at its current rate of energy production over its entire lifetime of about 10 billion years. So it's a tremendous amount of energy that is produced at once. And because of that, it has to be extraordinarily bright. So this is a distant galaxy. You can see how bright that object got. And so I just have a curve here. The astronomers actually can measure exactly how much energy this corresponds to, and from that they can infer how bright the object actually is. So this is actual data in terms of, these are absolute measures of absolute brightness of a bunch of different supernovae. Each line would correspond to one of the supernovas. As a function of time, and here are days, so you know, that's about 20 to 30 days is sort of this main peak here. And you'll notice that they have different brightnesses. But one of the things you see is if you look at this empirically, things that are a little dimmer happen to have shorter bright periods. So you can actually make a correlation between the length of the brightness here and the absolute brightness this direction, and you can correct. You can basically make a correction that puts them all on the same scale, so that no matter what the supernova is that you measure, you can relate it to this curve and get them all on the same curve. So once you've done that correction, that is, you see what the period of the supernova is, and based on that, you adjust your brightness calculation a little bit so that you get it basically on the same scale. Once you've done that, then we have an absolute measure of brightness that we really infer from the period of the supernova itself. And the period is easy to see. All we have to do is to see the thing turn on and fade away. So over a period of, you know, 10 to 30 days or something, you can actually get that measurement for individual supernova. So that's what people have done. And because we're looking at objects that are so very bright, you can look at objects that are very, very, very distant. And if you can look at objects that are very, very distant, you can look at how the expansion of the universe has changed over time, or whether it's been constant over time, because basically we're able to look at objects that are billions of light years away, which means you're looking over the expansion of the universe at least over billions of years. The kinds of things that you look at, if you look at the light coming from the supernova like we saw, we have instruments that are able to basically take the light of that single star and spectrum analyze it. And so when you do that and you spread it out in frequency, what you'll find are different bright and dark spots. This would be the intensity of the light as a function of frequency. And you can actually correlate these dips in intensity with spectral lines that you expect from different atoms and ions that absorb some of the light from the atom from the supernova as it comes toward us. And since these things are part of the galaxy that you have there, they'll have spectral lines that are shifted, so looking to see how much they shift gives you a measure of the velocity of the galaxy as it moves away from us. So you guys okay? Alright, so from this, if the universe is expanding, you extrapolate back in time, and as you extrapolate back in time, at a time about 13.8 billion years ago, you basically take something that's the size of our current universe and extrapolate back to zero. And so you say, okay, something happened at time zero, I don't know what, but when it did, I know that within a very short period of time, the energy density in the universe dropped to a level where we actually already probing with instruments. So we actually understand things about very energetic processes of accelerators and the nature of the various types of interactions. As you reach times, as we go backwards, you get to times about 10 to the minus 18 seconds after the Big Bang or so, that kind of time, we're actually probing energy processes at that energy. So once you sort of reach that stage, okay, so something happened and who knows what, but when we reach a stage where the energy density is sort of what it was about 10 to the minus 18 seconds after the Big Bang, we actually have a pretty good idea of the kinds of things that had to happen because we understand the nature of forces and how they vary. We understand what types of particles would be there because as you go to a universe which is more and more dense, then the interactions will produce more and more massive particles because in a sense that mass becomes irrelevant if the energy of interactions is much greater than that mass all the time. And so things will happen. So at about 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, as you go to the shorter periods, the energy density was greater than what you have inside of protons or neutrons, and the constituent particles inside the protons and neutrons would basically move around like a free gas or a free plasma. And we call that the quark-gluon plasma. At about 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, things cool down enough that those quarks sort of begin to condense into protons and neutrons. And so then we have protons and neutrons during that period, and it stayed that way. Well, then we had a period of about 3 minutes where those protons and neutrons were close enough together that they could react. There were enough free neutrons around that you had neutrons and you could actually form some light nuclei. We call this period Big Bang nucleosynthesis. At the end of this period, at the end of 3 minutes, all the light nuclei that were formed in the start of the Big Bang were pretty much set. And that's what then became the matter in our universe at that stage. So you had some light nuclei, we'll talk about this in a bit more, and mostly protons and electrons, and then there was light, so there's photons bouncing around. We have all of this stuff, so we have this gas, we call it a plasma because you don't have neutral atoms. You have free electrons and you have free protons and free light nuclei, all of which are electrically charged. And what that means is that the photons which are bouncing around in the universe don't stream freely. They keep getting absorbed and re-emitted and absorbed and re-emitted. So if I were able to take some of that material and put it in a bulb in my hand right here and you looked at it, what you would see is something is glowing, but you couldn't image anything in it. So lots of photons would be there. So it would glow, and it would have a temperature and everything. It would be above 3,000 degrees, roughly. But you couldn't image anything, because any photon that comes from something inside of it gets reabsorbed and scattered. So it's just like you were trying to look through frosted glass or something like that. Then at about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe cooled to about 3,000 degrees. What this means is that as the electrons occasionally bound with a proton or a light nucleus, neutral atoms would form, and the photons no longer had enough energy to knock them off. Remember, as things glow, the frequency range in which the glow happens depends on how hot it is. The hotter it is, the higher the frequency. The higher the frequency, the more energy the photons have, because E is equal to H nu, nu is the frequency. So if E is equal to H nu, then the energy of the photon is higher frequency. And so as the thing is hotter, all the photons have higher energies and they have enough energy to knock the electrons off of the neutral atoms. So prior to that time, it's all a plasma, and then at about that time, you get the universe turns into neutral atoms, And it becomes transparent at that moment to the photons that happen to be in the gas. And whatever happens to be in transit around that time just continues to stream freely because there's no longer something to absorb. It doesn't have enough energy to knock the electrons off of the neutral atoms. And because you don't have free charge particles, they don't just scatter. This period is called recombination for technical reasons, just in case you run across it. At this point, things then progress where you have the matter in the universe is expanding, things are cooling off, gravity slowly takes over. As gravity takes over, you begin to condense and form stars with nuclear fusion. The stars that are gravitationally bound will be formed in the you can form galaxies and galactic clusters, etc. As you form stars in the early formation period of the galaxies, the stars are pretty much just formed out of the primordial gases that are formed at the end of the Big Bang, the end of the 3 minutes. When those stars go through their life cycle and begin to go supernova, they begin to spread heavier elements around the universe because you have elements that are formed in the fusion processes in the stars, and then when they go supernova, you have even heavier elements that can be formed in the supernova processes, and that then ejects the material out into the galaxy, and then they can recondense into stars. So it turns out that if you look at different galaxies, particularly galaxies as a function of time in our universe, which you can do by looking at things that are further and further away, you actually find that the spectral lines that you see vary as you go back further and further in time. As you go back further and further in time, you see less and less of the heavier elements, and the reason you do is because you have no stars or supernova at that point in the universe. So there's this period between about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. For many, many years, you have no stars. It takes time for the stars and galaxies to form. So there's a period here which is a dark period, and then you begin to form stars and galaxies and such. And then as you get closer in time, you begin to see stars and galaxies which are made of heavier elements, so you get evidence for that. So there are lots of ways in which you can sort of study the history of the universe. So this is a schematic of the recombination. So in this case, you can imagine the universe's history going from left to right. And as you are, in terms of time, this would be at about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. This would be a good bit before. And as you go this direction in time, the temperature, the average temperature, is dropping. And it's around this level that you hit about 3,000 degrees and you begin to form neutral atoms. Prior to that, you see these things are all separated because the photons have enough energy to knock them off. So what you would see if you were looking at it is you would see sort of a glow here, but you wouldn't actually be able to image anything that's there because of that. And then once you begin to get the neutral atoms here, whatever photons are in here just stream freely, and the universe begins to look more like that, which is you'll have atoms and stuff, but you'll have the photons moving freely. And these are the photons that make up what we call the cosmic microwave background. So I know we talked about all this, so I don't know, but if you have any questions, do go ahead and ask them. Okay, so, you know, you have this very solid prediction of what has to come out of this crazy picture, and then the question is, do you see it? And I think you've seen the story of how these guys accidentally discovered this, what to them was basically a radio noise coming from all around us. And because it was just from everywhere all the time, they assumed it had something to do with their instrument, and it took them quite a while to figure out it didn't. And, of course, that disappointed some cosmologists at Princeton who were actually building an instrument at that time to go and look for this light coming from all directions that is the cosmic microwave background.
the light happens to be in the microwave region, even though it was emitted in what would be sort of the visible and UV region. And it's in the microwave region, so now it would look like an object that is at a temperature, it's glowing at a temperature with black body radiation of about 2.7 degrees Kelvin, so almost absolute zero. And the reason it looks like that is because that light has traveled in a universe where the space is expanding, and it's quite literally expanded the wavelength to a different wavelength. At any rate, this is a classic blackbody curve. This is actual real data on a theoretical blackbody curve, where the theoretical curve is something glowing at 2.7. So as you can see, it's basically a perfect fit, and it's an exact prediction. It's pretty well a prediction of what the Big Bang Theory would say. So this is a pretty phenomenal discovery, earning these two guys a Nobel Prize. And so in a sense, what we're looking at now, if you want to think about our cosmology, my laser pointers are starting to bite the dust right now. This is where we are right now. As we look at objects that are further and further from us, we are seeing galaxies that were formed, we were seeing light that is coming from galaxies that were younger and younger, that is, they were formed earlier and earlier in the universe. Eventually you'll reach a point where you're looking at objects that were just beginning to emit light because of fusion reactions and things happening. Galaxies beginning to form and stuff like that. There's a period from here to the cosmic microwave background, and so this would be a period after galaxies form is this way. Before the galaxies and stars form, you have this period where all the gas is just slowly condensing into them, and you don't have anything emitting light. And then you have this period where you have the whole universe is basically glowing, but recombination happens right in here. And so when recombination happens, that's when the cosmic microwave background is emitted. So effectively, we're looking at light that comes from this surface, which is called the last scattering surface. Because you can't image anything further back than that. Let me see if I have my other laser pointer here. Yeah, I've got something. Okay. So this sort of is what our cosmology is right now. Optically, you can't. This now looks opaque. It's the cosmic microwave background that we see. Any structure that you have on this cosmic microwave background gives you larger and smaller density regions as time progresses, and that's what condenses into the galaxies and galactic clusters, etc., that we see now. So this would be our cosmology centered on us at the moment. And depending, we'll come back to this, but depending, if we have some inkling of what the size of objects are at about 400,000 years after the Big Bang, which in a sense we do, because we know that the size through which things could have been causally connected was 400,000 light years at that point. So that's basically the size of this. We can then actually ask, that would correspond to the size of one of the larger features in the structure on the cosmic microwave background. And we can ask, how big does it appear to us now? And depending on the path that this light takes, the apparent angle we measure may differ. So I'll show you more on this in a minute, but that's sort of how we measure the flatness of the degree of flatness or the large-scale geometry in the universe. So we talked a little bit about Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Remember, what you have is a gas of protons and neutrons at high energies. And this is sort of a map of the processes that are seen that sort of form the light primordial nuclei. So you have protons and neutrons, and occasionally a neutron will glom onto a proton with a strong interaction, and you'll form what's known as deuterium if you add another proton, you might get helium. Another neutron, you might get helium-4. If you keep adding protons to the cycle, you might get some lithium-7 or some beryllium-7. If you just added another neutron, you'd get tritium. So this may look somewhat complex, but we do these kinds of things in the lab all the time. So these processes, in fact, are well understood. So what we expect to see in that gas in the early universe, or at least coming out of it, we understand. There's a limited period of time over which these nuclei, like beryllium, lithium, helium, deuterium, and tritium, can be formed. And the reason for that is that free neutrons have a finite lifetime. So if you form the free neutrons in 1 microsecond after the Big Bang, they are decaying away. The lifetime is on the order of, I forget what it is, 8 or 10 minutes, 8 or 18 minutes, something like that. But on the scale of things, after about 3 minutes, you have no longer enough free neutrons to glom onto anything to actually change anything ratio. So the primordial elemental densities are fixed at 3 minutes after the Big Bang. That process is known as Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And another way to look at it, we've seen before, is if we look at the time in the universe, this is 100 seconds, right? So this is somewhere around 3 minutes. This is a log scale. And what you'll see is that as time progresses, the temperature is dropping like a rock, the density is changing, and you start out with mostly protons and neutrons and almost nothing else, and then over a period where you have cooled enough that you can begin to have protons and neutrons sticking to one another and light nuclei, you begin to get light nuclei formed. So you begin to see some helium-3, some helium-4, some deuterium, lithium, etc. But then, because you lose all the free neutrons over a very quick period of time, at that point, the production of all these different types of light nuclei stops. And what you'll notice, this basically is the fraction of the mass in the universe for normal matter as a function of time. And note that this is a log scale, but basically at about 3 minutes or so, these things are roughly fixed. So if you have a prediction for what happens here, then you have a prediction for what the primordial mass density, what the primordial elements should be at the start of formation of galaxies and stars. And you can then use astronomical techniques to look at the very early galaxies and try to correct for any contamination that may be coming from later objects. But you can then look to make estimates of what the densities of these various elements happen to be in those early universe objects. And we find that it agrees very well with what we see in Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So if we look at the overall distribution of elements that we have around us now, and we ask where did they come from, in fact, the hydrogen and the helium, most of which we have around us, a lot of which came from the Big Bang. On Earth, some of the lithium and beryllium may have come from the Big Bang, but some is produced by cosmic rays interacting in the atmosphere. And then as you begin to move up in the periodic chart, what you'll find is that you have fusion processes that are energetically favorable, particularly in large stars, where you'll get things hotter and hotter in the core, all the way up to around iron. It turns out you'll also have some of these others form. But as you begin to get up around iron, it becomes energetically unfavorable to have fusion reactions happen. And so as you go further and further down the chart, the heavy elements pretty much are only born inside of the supernova. And even these other things, the green here, that are formed in the large stars in fusion processes, they're distributed in the cosmos to be part of our Earth, for example, through a supernova. Even if they weren't formed in a supernova, that's how they get ejected from the stars where they were formed out into the cosmos, where they then recondense into other stars. Okay, you guys all right? Any questions on any of that? All right. So these are sort of the main pieces of evidence for the idea of this Big Bang. We have strong evidence that space is expanding. We see the glow of the light from the period where you went from the charged plasma to the neutral atoms. And it is coming at us from all directions. It's a perfect black body that agrees with the temperature we would expect, given sort of the Big Bang picture. And the primordial distribution of elements agrees with what you would expect if you had a Big Bang happening and you basically took this hot soup of subatomic particles and cooked it for about 3 minutes as it cooled down. And in fact, when we go and look, we find that the primordial distribution agrees pretty well with what we see. So these are really detailed measurements, and it leads cosmologists to believe that, quite simply, the Big Bang had to happen. It's not contentious. Okay? So I hope you believe in that. And then, as we've talked about, what a load of crap. Because the Big Bang has really big problems. One, I'm going to show you a little bit more, but we have measured the large-scale geometry of the universe by looking at the size of features in the cosmic microwave background, of which we'll talk a lot more about, and we found it to be almost flat. But general relativity, if you want to solve some sort of universe, general universe, you could have arbitrary curvature in the fabric of space-time. And in fact, you would expect it to be curved in lots of ways, and very, very much so. So the flat space is a very special case. And although in principle you can balance things out in terms of how the universe is expanding and its matter density and all that stuff as it goes, to have a flat universe, it's a very fine-tuned solution, and nobody likes that kind of thing in science. You want whatever you see to sort of evolve organically. So that is known as the flatness problem, and the Big Bang theory itself doesn't really explain that. A very, very serious problem in this is that if we look at light, this is the cosmic microwave background light coming to us from one direction, and that which is coming to us from another direction. The region of the universe that emitted the light that we see coming that way and the region of the universe that emitted the light that's coming that way, remember that light was emitted some 13.3 billion years ago or so. The universe was much smaller. Our observable universe was much smaller. It was only about 380,000 light years or 400,000 light years in size. These regions of the universe that emitted that cosmic microwave background light had never been in causal contact with one another at the time that light was emitted in the Big Bang theory. So that's a real issue. It's called the horizon problem. And the reason it's a real issue is because this light looks exactly like that light. And by that I mean it has exactly the same temperature and black body spectrum. And you can only get some things at uniform temperature, basically they touch each other, right? Because the heat has to flow and they have to know what the other temperature is. Even if it was, you know, some strange high-density cosmic alien that was turning on a light to emit the light, this alien had to know what temperature that alien set its light at. So to have this uniformity that we have to one part in 10 to the fifth, and to have these parts of the universe having never been in causal contact with one another is again, a huge problem. Another problem that comes up with just strict Big Bang theory is that we don't know how to induce the structure or the asymmetries in the non-uniformities in the expanding universe that would eventually condense into the galaxies and dogs and things that we observe. That's called the large-scale structure problem. And then we have the other issue is that if you go back in time, you get the infinite energy densities and infinitely small extent for the universe, and basically our physics breaks down. And so we call that the singularity problem. And what do you make of that? There's an additional problem which I don't know that I said much about, but it turns out to be important. There is a type of particle called a magnetic monopole, which we would sort of expect to see in the universe. And if we look hard, we don't see any of them. And so that's called the magnetic monopole problem, which I don't list. Oh, I guess I do list it here. So
we don't see magnetic monopoles for whatever reason, for whatever they are, but they're theoretically compelling and should exist and should have been formed in the early universe. So if you believe in the Big Bang, you really have your homework cut out for you, because these are all, every one of them is sort of a serious theory-killing sort of problem. Okay, let me see if I can get this to work. In terms of measuring the geometry of space, here's a video that
this is the WMAP satellite. It's a video from the WMAP group. But basically the idea is you look at the size of structures in the cosmic microwave background. We'll talk a lot more about that. And depending on the size that you see, you effectively get a measure of the overall curvature of the space itself. So depending on the curvature, the spots are going to look, the structures that you see will look smaller or larger. And so given that you have arguments you can make where you effectively know the size of those spots and you know the distances, by looking at the apparent sizes that you measure, you effectively get a measure of the overall geometry of the universe. So that's sort of how we know that we believe it's flat, or one of the ways, anyway. You guys okay? All right. So you can fix all these problems with this absolutely wacky idea called inflation. So this is the story that we've just been looking at. This is the history of the universe. These lines represent the time in the universe. This is the temperature in the universe. This is the energy that's in a typical interaction as you go in the universe. This is today. This is this would be about 1 microsecond. This would be about 380,000 years. So this is where the cosmic microwave background is released. And as we go back further and further in time, we reach a point where physics begins to break down. And so the idea that fixes all of these crazy problems that we were just talking about the Big Bang, is that if you start out with the universe, which is very, very small, so these are the guys that we generally credit for having come up with this scheme. You start out with the universe that's very, very, very small. Everything is causally connected. And then in a very short period, after this quantum fluctuation started, at about 10 to the minus 35 seconds or so, you have a condition in the space that causes it to inflate by a factor of about 10 to the 50 or something. And when you do that, you take things that are causally connected. This expansion happens so fast, it's vastly faster than the speed of light goes. It basically takes a region which was to become our universe and makes it vastly larger than our observable universe. And when you do that, then basically the conditions map on to what we would expect from the Big Bang. But you have taken things that were in causal contact and made them much bigger. This turns out to fix all the problems that we have, or most of the problems we have with the Big Bang. So, for example, regardless of the curvature of the space, when you stretch it out, the cosmic scales, the large-scale curvature of the universe will be flat. If you have it very small, basically quantum fluctuations will give you patterns of different energies over very short period, very short distances. You then spread that out over cosmic scales all of a sudden. You effectively freeze the energy fluctuations in that early part of the universe, and that naturally gives you a spectrum of variation of energy in the whole volume of the universe, which would naturally lead to large-scale structure that we see. So this idea of inflation takes the very small quantum fluctuations and stretches them out cosmic scales and can lead to large-scale structure. So you sort of fix that problem. Now, it doesn't completely fix the problem. You have to do more work. So before you can believe that inflation might be a real thing, you also have to look at what the different sizes would be that you would expect to happen. Because we have some sense of what quantum fluctuations are, then we have some sense of what the cosmic sizes of these various structures should be and how often they should appear. So there's sort of a scale of how often you see the different size structures as a function of where in our universe. And people had to do that analysis to have a sense of whether inflation might work. So it does map pretty well. This early stage of the universe is basically the size of a quantum fluctuation in something or nothing, depending on whose theory you're looking at. And that we deal with all the time. So we don't really have to have a singularity for that. And we'll talk a bit about that in a minute. If you have in the early universe lots of magnetic monopoles form, if you now take it and you stretch it out to cosmic scales, the density of those magnetic monopoles drops to zero. So you shouldn't see magnetic monopoles, which we don't. So it solves that problem. And then because you started out very small, with a small fluctuation that you then expanded to cosmic scales, all of what we see as our observable universe was in causal contact and then was stretched out to not be in causal contact. But because it was at some point, there really is a relationship between this part of the universe and that part of the universe, so it isn't a mystery anymore that they should give us the same energy of glow. Okay? Okay, so there have been some surprises that, in a sense, aren't part of the story but have become an integral part of the story. One was the discovery of what we now call cold dark matter, first observed or inferred by Fritz Zwicky by looking at the rotational motion of galaxies in a galactic cluster and trying to relate the mass that must be there for them to move that way to the mass he would infer from the amount of brightness and stars that he saw in those galaxies. And he found that there was a mismatch there by almost a factor of 10. There was more gravitationally interacting matter in the galactic cluster than you could infer from the light. So that was a bit of a puzzle. In the, early 60s, maybe early 70s, Vera Rubin and Kent Ford did the same sort of study looking at the rotational motion of stars around the center of a galaxy. And what they found was, again, in order to get the rotational motion that they saw to work, they had to infer the existence of a lot more mass in the galaxy than one could reasonably assume was there based on the density of stars and things that we understand. And then there's other evidence where people have actually looked at the distribution of matter that we can see versus evidence for gravitational pull that you get from looking at gravitational lensing. So in general relativity, if you have a heavy object, it bends light as it goes around it, and you can actually use that bending to infer the distribution of gravitating mass, if you want to think of it that way. And this is a case where you have two gravitational clusters passing through each other, and this purplish regions here and here that have moved past each other happen to be where most of the mass lies. And this bright stuff here happens to be normal matter that's emitting X-rays. And what they discovered was that the normal matter will interact with itself, but that most of the mass actually just went right through one another. And again, it's sort of an indirect evidence that there is matter out there that we're not observing. We call it cold dark matter. What we really know is that it interacts gravitationally, it has mass, it does not have electric charge, or it would interact with light. It also doesn't interact strongly. We have other reasons to believe that it's not sort of what we would call baryonic matter, so it's not made of protons and neutrons and stuff. So we're trying to puzzle out what it is, but there's a lot of it in our universe, and it does affect the patterns we see in the early stage of the universe. Another huge surprise that came up about not that long ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, these guys won the Nobel Prize for it, was what we called the discovery of dark energy. What they really discovered was they were doing the Hubble curve experiment, but on steroids. They were looking at objects further and further away, more and more of them, in order to look at the expansion of the universe as a function of time. And what they find, if they plot that, so this would be basically distance, and this is the distances between galaxies, and this is the time of flight. They effectively look at different possible curves. And one of the things you'll see is in the universe in the early stages, it was slowing down in its expansion, but now it's actually starting to speed up. And what they measure basically is all this data. And it may not overwhelm you right now, but it does actually correspond to an accelerating expansion of the universe. The reason we call it dark energy is because in the cosmological equations we use to describe the evolution of the universe, you can make the expansion happen if you add an energy term with the right sign. It basically corresponds to energy, potential energy that's stored in the vacuum of space itself. We don't know exactly what's causing it, but we're trying to, different models would give you different details in terms of how this evolution happens. So people are trying to do these studies with more and more statistics and distances to get better estimates of, or get better data to see if we can distinguish. So we call that dark energy. Again, if we have something that is affecting the potential energy stored in space, it basically can affect the evolution of the space itself, the degree to which it expands or contracts. And so, again, if you look at the patterns available in the early stages of the universe, you'll be sensitive to how much dark energy is there as well. So although it doesn't come straight out of anything like the Big Bang, or even inflation necessarily, we really have to understand the extent to which it's there in order to understand what we see in the early universe. So this is one of the guys who came up with this idea of inflation, Alan Guth at MIT. And I love this quote of his. Basically, what's happening is you have this period of inflation, and you think, well, that's crazy, because it has to totally break conservation of energy. But as it expands, you're also creating gravitational potential energy in the universe itself, which actually comes in with a negative sign. So it turns out that the energy of expansion and the negative sign you get from the actual expansion itself that feeds in, they pretty much cancel out. And so Alan says this total energy, matter plus gravitational, remains constant and very small and could even be exactly zero. That is, the universe could come from nothing. If inflation is right, everything can be created from nothing, or at least from very little. If inflation is right, the universe can properly be called the ultimate free lunch. How about that? This is, I just ran across this as I was trying to come with some visuals for this. This is the page of his logbook when he had his insight. And he even realized it was a pretty cool insight. Spectacular realization. But then, immediately you realize he's not thinking anything like what we're talking about. He is, but at the time, he called it supercooling. Which, of course, has happened. You have this quantum inflation, and then, you know, in a sense, you could think of it as supercooling, an adiabatic expansion, similar to what happens, maybe in some sense, when you have a gas under pressure that you blow out a nozzle in a spray can as it expands, and there's no heat flow. It gets very, very cool. At any rate, so this is where he claims he had his idea in 1979, and then went off and started playing with the calculations. I was pretty impressed at how neat his logbook is, actually. I mean, mine looks nothing like that when I do something by hand. At any rate, so there are different schemes for what drives this inflation, and really there are different frameworks with which you can try to describe it and look at it. But my favorite, in terms of conveying it, really comes out of string theory, which we've talked a lot about recently, so I'll just mention this very fast. If you have this idea that the fundamental particles of nature, the fundamental components, are little strings, and you then try to use vibrations in those strings to give you the mass spectrum of the particles that you see, you basically are doing what's called string theory. And when you try to take a theory of this sort and make it potentially work and be self-consistent and not have real problems and basically have the kinds of particles like fermions and bosons that we see in the universe today, and you don't create solutions that are known to be bad, it turns out for that to happen, you pretty much have to have it in 10 dimensions of space, which we know doesn't make sense. So they made 6 of these dimensions go away, or 7 of them, like, well, 9 plus time probably, and then you make 6 go away to get to the 3 space plus time. You use compactification, so here you have a 2-dimensional object, you roll it up like this, and now if you let this dimension go very small or you step very far away, this 3-dimensional object now looks like a 1-dimensional object. So you can make dimensions go away by effectively curling them up on very small scales. The thing is, when you do that with 6 dimensions, you get really complex spaces. And in a sense, you're doing this at every point in space. You have these dimensions all curled up. And because you have so many different ways in which you can do this, 10 to the 500-ish of them, in fact, life is potentially complicated. So string theory religion is, wow, all I have to do is find the ultimate way to curl up these dimensions of space, and because the way in which they're curled determines things like electric charge and the nature of forces, as well as the potential energy that's stored in the space itself, I can pretty much answer everything and tell you why our universe is the way that it is. The problem is, because there are 10 to the 500 of these possibilities, you actually have lots of local minima in the phase space of all the ways in which you can sort of twist these things up. So it's hard to imagine that you'll find the ultimate best answer. And we'll come back to that. So if you look at the cosmic microwave background, when it was discovered, it looked completely the same everywhere if you adjusted for the Doppler shift in frequency from the motion of the Earth through the cosmos. And then as our instruments improved, we finally improved them to the point that they were sensitive to differences in the color or frequency coming from the cosmic microwave background at a level of 1 part in 10 to the 5th. And when we began to be able to make pictures of the universe all around us at that precision and put it in a 2-dimensional projection, basically, early on it was discovered to look like this. You can see that the resolution of the instrument is limiting you here, because when you go to a better instrument, you get this, and when you go to an even better instrument, you get this. And so this is the current state of the art from the European Space Agency's Planck satellite. So this is a picture that shows very clearly that there was structure in the early stage of the universe, because what you're seeing, remember, is these are photons. This is light that's traveling from 380,000 years after the Big Bang. It's traveled free stream to us. And what we're seeing is that that light was emitted from regions of space that slight variations in how hot they were. That corresponds to energy variations. So you can see this variation then in the inflation theory basically is a picture of the energy variations you see in quantum fluctuations stretched out the cosmic scale. And these variations should be the variations that then condense into galactic clusters and galaxies and things that we see. So it is this structure really becomes what our universe is. Okay? So then a lot of the excitement has happened in studying the details of this, because there's a great deal of information about the early stage of the universe and how things have evolved that is tied up in the frequency of how many spots you see of the different sizes, I guess is a way to say it, and how much they vary in temperature. So you can study that by literally looking at the frequency of the different size spots in nature. We do it using what's called a multipole expansion, but it doesn't matter in terms of technical details. All I really want to point out is that if you describe different size structures by different L numbers, whatever that is, okay, L of 2 would correspond to a universe that would look like this, that is, very few large structures. Then L equals 16 would correspond to a universe with lots of smaller structures. You know, L equals 1,000 would be lots of little tiny dots. And one of the things you see, if you look at the picture, is that you have a lot of these different things happening all at once, right? You see sort of large regions like that, and you see lots of little tiny regions as well. And so what we do is effectively break this pattern down into a spectrum in this L, which is a measure of how frequently you see the different size objects. It's called a power spectrum of the early universe. And here's a picture of it coming out of about WMAP time. I'll show you the Planck satellite's measurements in a moment. So what you see is effectively how often you see objects of a certain size. And the data gives you a particular curve. And in this case, you have a theoretical model for an evolution of the universe, which generally, even at this stage, was sort of consistent with an inflationary universe that contained cold dark matter and dark energy. The thing is, you're actually sensitive to how much dark matter and dark energy was there. Here is modern data from the Planck collaboration. And when you take your theoretical model and you ask, okay, I'm going to have inflation and I'm going to let this thing evolve. And as it evolves, the thing is, what do you start out with? You have quantum fluctuations in energy. So you have a structure in energy in terms of space. And now stretch it out to be the size larger than our observable universe. Size of the cosmos, sort of thing. I have energy fluctuations. Those effectively correspond to density perturbations in the early universe, because energy is distortions in the gravitation, in space-time, and also converts into matter. So you can think of these energy perturbations as corresponding to density perturbations in the early universe. And if you just imagine density perturbations in a gas, if I put a high density here in the middle of a gas, it will propagate out. And that's basically what you call sound waves. So when this is also known as basically an acoustic spectrum of the early universe, because I take these density perturbations in the early universe and I ask, what did that pattern look like at 380,000 years later? So I take that initial pattern and it's going to propagate just like the sound waves are propagating in the room and the density perturbations all sort of evolve. So you study how that evolves, and how that evolves is going to depend on a few things. The size of those perturbations in 380,000 years is going to depend on, one, how fast you're expanding the space itself in normal expansion, so Hubble expansion as opposed to inflation. But that's going to change how these things evolve. How much of the matter is normal matter, which interacts with itself and sort of exerts a pressure on itself, and how much of it is cold, dark matter that doesn't seem to interact very easily with itself. So if I have a gas of matter right here and I move my hand through it, I will feel it. Okay, it will exert a pressure. And so that will cause the shape to evolve. If I have the same amount of mass, but it's dark matter, if I could do that, my hand would go right through it. I wouldn't feel a thing. So if I have a dark matter density perturbation wave, in a sense, it's going to dissipate at a different speed. It won't dissipate as fast as normal matter because it won't exert pressure on itself. So if you have this sort of model of trying to understand how these different size perturbations are evolving, you are sensitive to the fraction of dark matter versus the fraction of normal matter versus how much of the total energy budget in the universe is actually just in the dark energy piece, which is expanding in space. So when you do this analysis, what they find is that the energy budget of the universe is such that the normal matter that we're used to, the stuff that interacts with light, everything that we understand in particle physics today, is only about 5% of the universe's energy budget. We have another 20-some percent, which is gravitating mass, but doesn't seem to interact with light, doesn't do the strong interaction, and we haven't actually figured out what it is, but it's called dark matter. And we have a lot of indirect evidence that we have it, but this is another piece of evidence that it's there, because to get a good fit to the data, you have to have it. Similarly, we know that the universe's expansion is accelerating, so we know there is something tied up in this energy term. We don't know what it is, but we call it dark energy, and again, to get a good fit to the data, you have to have it. So do you believe in this crap? Well, here is, I think this was, this was pre-Planck, so this is the earlier data, it's not as good. But this is actually an article from Guth, where I like it because it shows different cosmological models and how they fit to data. And so here's, for example, inflation and dark energy, and it fits the data pretty well. But if I take just an inflationary model and I don't have the dark energy, it's this green line, and it doesn't fit anything very well at all. And then you can have other models. So, is this a smoking gun that supports the idea of inflation? No, but it's pretty compelling, actually, that inflation may have happened. And in fact, that wasn't the curve that I showed, but the Planck collaboration did this work. And in a paper that they recently put out in analyzing their data in the multipole size expansion on cosmic microwave background radiation, this is the conclusion from their paper, that we find the standard, and there's a particular way of doing the inflation, slow roll, single model, so-and-so field inflation, is compatible with the Planck data. Okay, so it's not a smoking gun that inflation happened, but it's fairly compelling stuff.
So maybe this is a good place to stop. I think I'm out of time, but what I wanted to do next was to talk about a very recent result as of March 17. I think I forwarded an email to you with a link at the start of the class, but at that stage it was all, should have been gobbledygook to most of you. So what I want to do now is to actually talk about this new discovery from March 17th, which is pretty spectacular, and many people sort of think of it as a smoking gun for scientific evidence that inflation actually happened. So we'll start there on Monday. So have a good weekend.